So what I want to discuss today is really I want to introduce a certain set of values and then really to ask questions that I don't want to answer until next week, because I actually think it's very important for us to think about these questions more than it is for us to answer them immediately. Something would be lost if we made an attempt to answer them too soon. I don't want to say before we actually see the text inside what exactly my question is, but it bothers me very much. I think it's complicated, and so that's the plan for today. So we're going to continue on in order in Sefer Mishlei. We're doing the ninth parak now, and the ninth parak begins in the following way with an extended mashal, extended parable. I'm going to read the Hebrew and give my own translation, but as always, I've provided a translation that I think is a pretty good one. So the Mishlei begins as follows, the ninth parak. Chachmot banta beta, wisdom, who's being compared again to a woman, has built her house solidly. Chatzva amudeha shiva, she has laid all seven foundations. The image is one of like great stability and strength. For its wisdom in this mashal, in this metaphor, is building a home of a very stable foundation. The point really is that wisdom gives a person structure, a person a set of coherent values through which they can understand the world instead of being at sea, lost in chaos. So wisdom has built for itself a very solid house with seven foundations. Tavcha tivcha, it prepares its meat. Tevach is meat. Mashcha yena, poured its wine, aporcha shulchana. And inside this beautiful mansion that wisdom has built, not only is the outside impressive, the foundation stable and solid, but inside it's organized. It's one of those homes that you walk into, and a table is set, and there's meat on the table, and wine has been poured, and it's set beautifully with all of those utensils. You don't even know what most of them do. It's like when you go to those museums and they have 900 forks on the table and each one was for a different piece of asparagus. It's a tremendous level of organization. Impressive structure and stability. And so this royal woman who is wisdom in the analogy, Shalchana Roseha Tikra, she sends out her maidservants to make the following announcement. Algape Mirome Keres, from all of the high places in the city. Right. So she sends out her maidservants. She's being presented as an aristocrat, as royal, as almost a queen. She runs this very beautiful home with great structure and organization and stability. And she sends out her maidservants to say the following on all the high places of the city. Mi feti asur hena, whoever is naive, whoever lacks wisdom, should come over to this home. Chasar lev amralo, and to those who lack wisdom, she says to them, lechu lachmu velachmi, come to my home, partake of my bread, ushesu v'yayin masachti, and drink from the wine that I have poured. In the metaphor, meaning, right, we're saying they should go over to her house, they should eat from her bread, they should drink from her wine. In the what do you think the message here is? Exactly. In other words, her wisdom is exactly as Don is saying, is being portrayed as meat and bread and wine, all the fine delicacies that she, wisdom, has to offer. She tells her maidservants to advertise throughout the city. Azvu fitayim v'chiyu. Okay, and say to all the fools out there, the naive people, the unlettered people, the ignorant people, tell them to leave their path of foolishness and they will live. V'yishru b'derech bina. They should go forward in happiness in the way of understanding. Okay, so we have an extended mashal, not unlike many other mashalim that we have in the Sefer, where the voice of wisdom is portrayed as a royal woman. That's always very important. We've spoken about Eishes Chayil many times. A royal woman, a woman of great means, who has much to offer, stability, structure, and all fine things. The next three psukim would bother me very much, and this is going to be our central question today. But, says wisdom, in a voice that up until now has been very magnanimous and extremely generous and looking out for everybody in the city and trying to educate those who lack wisdom and morals. But then, in the next three psukim, the tone changes dramatically, and it's very complex. Yoser Leitz warns wisdom. Those who try to rebuke the scorner, who try to correct the person who's a cynic, they will get nothing for it rather than lokeach lo kalon. All they will get for their hard work is they'll be scorned themselves. Kalon literally means shame. In other words, a person who tries to straighten out somebody who's on the wrong path, a cynic, a scorner, he will get nothing other than shame for himself. Umochiach l'rasha, somebody who tries to rebuke the wicked person, mumo, he will himself be blemished. He will himself suffer for it. Al tochach leitz, rebuke not the scorner, the cynic, pen yisna eka, lest he hate you. Hochach l'chacham v'yehav eka, rather, reserve your critique for the wise person, and he will love you. He will appreciate it. It's really these two psukim that bother me more than anything else. And what bothers me so much about it is I don't understand. Here you have wisdom, which was, you know, advertising from all the high places in the city, renting out all the billboards, and saying, come to me, uneducated ones, ignorant ones, come to me and be educated, partake of my bread, of my wine, of my meat, and gain the benefits that I have to offer, the structure and the stability that the Perek started with, a sevenfold foundation. So now when it comes to the people who seemingly need wisdom the most, the cynics, the scorners, the wicked ones, are we abandoning them? Well, what is Mishlei saying? What is the voice of wisdom saying? That, oh, if you, you know, worry about those who are scorners and cynics, you're gonna reap nothing but shame, and you're not gonna benefit at all. In fact, you'll be blemished from it. And so it bothers me. It seems like we're turning our backs on the ones who we need to be reaching out to the most.
Is this so deviant, or from what you really have in Passover, in terms of like the four children, you know, supposed to encourage, bring them in, and responsibility to educate, but the wicked side. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The whole idea is to say, this is my status, this really was not for you.
I think it's a great parallel, so I would just ask the question, right, how does one justify that? Doesn't the wicked son need it the most?
Maybe the wicked son is too corrupting of an influence to be as
But do we really, I think Don is saying really important things, but I just want to push back for a second. Do we really believe in that? Don't we believe in the idea of repentance? I mean, in Judaism, we say that a person has literally until their deathbed, and all they have to do is to have contrition for what they did, and that's it. Why are we turning our backs on people who are... So I think that's a very valid perspective that Yehudis is raising. Yeah, Beth, or do you want to...
Yeah, I want to just comment on something. It says, Tein lechacham v'yachcham.
Yeah, the next pasuk, right.
So we're saying, like, what, you can ask the question, well, why do you have to tell them to reprove the chacham, somebody who's a tzaddik or a chacham?
Right.
Because they want to know, and they want to do the right thing, but they may not know.
Right.
I think the difference is somebody who's innocent or doing the wrong thing out of ignorance, or somebody who may know and is rejecting it, who you don't, your reproof is going to be fruitless, because...
Okay, so I think one can distinguish between three reasons. Let's present three reasons why you might not want to rebuke someone who is a cynic or a scorner. The first approach would be that it will just be neutral, nothing will come of it. You're wasting your time. Better use your energy and your resources somewhere else, don't deal with the frustration. It's not going to lead anymore. Okay, that would be one, I guess, valid explanation for why you shouldn't rebuke anybody who's a cynic. It's not going to get you anywhere. The second approach would be to say, no, it's not that it's going to be neutral, it'll be counterproductive. What's going to happen? You're going to try to tell a person that, let's say, person's doing a tax fraud. It happens all the time. You're going to, yeah, very typical thing. So a person's scamming the government, they're stealing, it's illegal, and you tell them, you know, it's wrong. You may get caught, you might not get caught. If you get caught, you'll be in very serious trouble, but it's wrong. Stealing. So according to the first approach, it's just not going to help. Second approach is the person's going to resent it very deeply. And not only are they going to do a tax fraud, but they'll become emboldened and more brazen, and they're going to have a reactionary response. So I would understand that on some level. I'm not sure I would be entirely comfortable with that, because I think that, as we're going to see, you might still have an obligation. But I think if you read Mishlei carefully, that's not what he's saying. He's giving a reason that I consider much less justifiable. Namely, what does he say? Going back to the 8th verse here, Al tochach leitz, what's his rationale? Al tochach leitz, do not rebuke the cynic, pen yisna'eka, because he's not going to like you. It's not about you. Who cares? Life is not a popularity contest. Religion is not a popularity contest. So let him not like you. That's not as good a reason as saying it's not going to get you anywhere. It's certainly not as good a reason as saying it's going to be counterproductive. So what does Mishlei have in mind?
Robert.
Yes, Sam.
Okay, maybe he's not telling you not to do it. This might be like a word to the wise should be sufficient. That if you do these things, it doesn't mean you should do it.
Interesting.
You do it, but you know what the end result will be. That
right.
You will be mocked, you will be hated, but maybe do it. In spite of that.
That would be very, I would love it if you were saying, I think that I...
You can say you do not.
Right.
But the verse in...
Right.
Whoever corrects it doesn't say you shouldn't, it's just whoever doesn't, that's...
I love Stanley's idea. All I can say is that the simple reading again of verse 8 is, Al tochach leitz, do not rebuke him, pen yisna'eka, lest he's going to hate you.
Okay, that's
so
all
you have to have a very creative
reading. Okay, but he might be hate, but maybe still do it.
But he says, not to do it.
But it doesn't say don't.
Yeah, reverse the simple.
Yeah,
I don't agree. I think you're very forward. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it says don't rebuke him, but it doesn't say not
Okay, so what Yehudis is saying is it's not total abandonment. We're not really turning our back on the person, and I completely agree, because there are other ways of communicating them. What's the most classical example of this? If you heard this idea, we have really two models. One of them, you know, certain in terms of reaching out to people who are wayward. One of them is the path of. Go ahead. You want to give an example, or I agree. Was there a particular example you had in mind, or?
That was his whole life. Not really, not
love,
because that didn't work.
Yeah, so Avram was a very... I think the best example is even in the Mishnah in Perkei Avos, it talks about Aaron HaKohen, and it says that basically that he was Ohev es Habrios, he loved people, Umikarvan the Torah. So I just wanted to share with you something that was developed by Chazal and Avos to Rabbi Nassan, which is an expansion of Perkei Avos, or basically... Aaron took a different approach. Aaron didn't take the first and the most straightforward approach is to try to discuss things with people and have a frontal conversation about why it's not a good idea to do a tax scam. Why is it not a good idea to do an insurance fraud? I mean, these are things people do all the time. Why is it not a good idea to traffic organs? And that would be the first approach, is to have a direct conversation. Aaron took a different approach, which was he would hang out with people who were generally considered low lives.
Rabbi Grossman.
Who's Rabbi Grossman?
From Megillah.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like people who are low-life, like Rabbi Grossman. I was like, who's Rabbi Grossman? But, got it. He came here. I wasn't here that Shabbos, but I know. I
was not.
Right. Well, I don't know about his work in depth, but...
The disco rabbi. I used to go into discos in Tel Aviv.
Oh, he's the disco rabbi?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I just know the phrase, the disco rabbi. Okay, it's all coming together for me.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, all I know
in this book.
So all I know about is about Aaron. I can share with you about Aaron. So it says that he was hanging out with people who were low lives, and he would just talk to them. Basically, he would feign ignorance, that he really didn't know that these guys were up to no good, and he would just treat them really nicely. And they would all say to each other, after he would leave, they would say to each other, if Aaron knew that I was such a rotten person, he would never talk to me. He would never hang out with me. So it'd just be a shame. Because they felt badly that they were bringing Aaron down by association. Aaron is the high priest. He spends most of his time doing korbanos and the Holy of Holies. You know, they just felt awkward about it. So they said, okay, well, we have no choice now but to improve, because Aaron doesn't understand who he's dealing with. He doesn't understand that we're really rotten guys. And he's not going to stop hanging out with us. But we don't want to taint him by association. So that's a whole different approach that Yehudis is talking about, which I think can help us very, very much. I'm not entirely satisfied, though, because let's say that doesn't work. Yehudis, in a perfect world, it would be wonderful and it would work. But a lot of times you have people who are not moved by that. You'll befriend them and they'll just say, okay, did you want to join me in my little... welcome you with open arms into their insurance fraud, into their, you know, organ trafficking scheme. So why don't you have the recourse of being able to correct them, of being able to say, it's not right what you're doing. I've had enough.
I keep thinking of when...
Dana, we can make room at the table. You don't have to... You're not in exile.
I keep thinking of when he said God offered the Torah to all the different nations,
sure.
And he didn't argue with them, he just won't die until he found Israel.
Well, right, because you could be, but that's true, because you could be a good person and not be Jewish. You could be a person who is a Gentile and keeps the seven Noahan laws, a wonderful person. There's nothing to rebuke him about. But here, it's very troubling to me. Why are we abandoning our fellow Jews? The person is wayward. You can do Yehudis' approach, but it might not always work. It likely won't work. And you need a little tough love. What's wrong with a little tough love? And Stanley was trying to say, well, you should do it anyway, but that's not what Mishlei said. I happen to like Stanley's idea. But,
no, because you make more enemies that
way. Okay, but maybe you should and then we'll take Donnie's question in a second, but Gladys, maybe you should be willing to have enemies to do the right thing. Life is not a popularity contest. Only student council elections are a popularity contest.
No, but you don't want to increase the evil in the world.
So that argument is what we said before. Either you could say, look, it's not going to get you anywhere, it's just a waste of time. They'll hear you out, but then they'll just say, get lost. The second approach that we gave is to say, okay, they'll be counterproductive because they'll just resent you and then they'll want to say, how can I be even more evil? If Shlomo had given that reason, I'm not sure I would be fully satisfied, but I would at least understand it, because it would just be a tactical thing and say, look, of course the right thing to do is to pull out all the stops for a fellow Jew. If a fellow Jew is on the wrong path, you have to do... Don't hide in your greener pastures. You're not better than them. Help them. Do whatever you can. So if you told me that it's just, going to be counterproductive, fine. But that's not what Shlomo says. Shlomo says, Al tochach leitz, pen yisna echa. Because he's not going to like you. And maybe he'll embarrass you back. But big deal. You're not willing to suffer a little embarrassment for a fellow Jew? You're not willing to go through a little pain, make a few enemies? Sometimes it's worth it. Yeah, done.
Well, you just started out from the beginning separating these two, right?
Mm-hmm.
These two parts.
Right.
And then you focused on this one part right here.
Mm-hmm.
What was the separation? I didn't understand the separation. I tried reading it.
So the first part is when the person of wisdom, the woman of wisdom, says, go out and find all the people who we can help, all the ignorant people in town, and bring them over to the palace, and we're going to teach them. That's up until Pasuk Vav. Then starting in Pasuk Zion, she completely changes and says, oh, but by the way, there are certain people you shouldn't reach out to, the people who need us the most, the people who are the most cynical and most wicked. Don't try to talk to them. It won't get you anywhere, and they're not going to like you. So what I'm wondering about is that transition. It's easy in certain respects to educate those who just aren't educated. You bring them in, it's wonderful. But the people who really need chachma, who really need the stability, the sevenfold foundation that we started with, those are the people who are wicked. So why don't we care about them? They need us the most. So I find it to be a very difficult, we're not going to answer the question fully, I think, until next week. But what I really wanted to present is why I think this is so troubling. It's not so easy to understand why Mishlei isn't saying, pull out all the stops for those who are wicked. You know, there have always been wicked Jews. Always people. They go back to the times of the Torah, to Moshe Rabbeinu.
But you are saying you understand the first part.
The first part is, I think, wonderful. The first part is, you know, wisdom has so much to offer. It's like a palace built on 7 foundations. It has, in the metaphor, it has fine meats and wines and a full table of delicacies to offer, namely all kinds of good advice for people, all kinds of helpful things that can give people great structure and stability. And that's the first 6 verses of the Perek. And then we have this very radical change. I wanted to just go in a number of more psukim to before we do anything else, to really just sharpen the question. This is verse 9, that we haven't read this in time. Beth pointed it out, but I just wanted to read it now. Tein l'chacham, rather, says wisdom, you know who you should address yourself to? Tein l'chacham, give your wisdom to who? The chacham, the person who's already a chacham. V'yechkam od, and let them grow wiser. Hoda l'tzadik v'yosef lechach. Make your morality, your wisdom known to the righteous person, and they will grow even wiser. So to me, this is about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. I'm not sure I understand this. Now, there's no reason we have to discriminate. There's no reason we can't have advanced education courses for the people who are already quite wise and already understand a lot. And Tein L'chacham is a wonderful thing. And nobody knows everything, and everybody has what to learn and what to grow. As we've discussed many times, the Mishnah from Pirkei Avos, Eizehu Chacham, who is a wise person, Havo Meid Mikol Adam, who is willing to keep on learning. Wonderful. But what I don't understand is this kind of cherry picking. You know, I was reading in the Times this past week. This is something Beth knows a lot about when it comes to charter schools. There's a big debate right now about public schools versus charter schools. Everybody here has heard of the charter school movement. Charter schools are a specific kind of public school in all over the country, but it's a very big deal in New York City. That is in the public education system. And the charter schools have been criticized for years. There are rumors that they were cherry-picking the smart kids, which is illegal. In other words, they're supposed to take from the same general population as everybody else. And what the charter schools have an incentive to do this, because the higher their scores are, the more money they can get, the more successful they are, the better recruiting they have. But it's obviously unethical. Because what happens is then all the regular kids are still in the public schools, and it's unfair. We're not talking about magnet schools, we're talking about regular schools. So for the first time, they actually documented evidence of this. I saw it 2 weeks ago. They have documented evidence of this. So this, to me, sounds not altogether that different. If you want to generate great results, you know, in terms of spreading wisdom and ethics, what do? You recruit all the chachamim. But is that ethical? Is that really what it's about? Don't we have a responsibility to everybody else? Especially the cynics and the scorners? So it's a little troubling. Not only that, but as we'll see, we'll continue to read the Perek. I think it gets even worse in a certain respect. Remember the image, the first 6 psukim, the image and the metaphor of a regal woman who is a hostess in a beautiful palace mansion type place with a fancy table with fine meats and offering wonderful delicacies to the community. Now we have a contrast to that. The last 6 psukim of the Perek presents yet another woman with a completely opposite message. And the psukim use the same exact phrases, but with the opposite connotation. So instead of the wise woman who is hostess and master of a particular house, Eishes Ksilos Homia, the woman of folly, calls out, Fetayus Uval Yadama. She is foolish and unwise. V'yashvala petach beta, and she sits too in her house, much like the woman of wisdom sits in her house and calls to the community outside. V'yashvala petach beta, the foolish woman sits in her home, al kisei mirome kares, again, from the high places. That is the exact phrase that we had in verse 3, al gape mirome kares. Again, both of them are broadcasting their message. Imagine a radio, and you have on one frequency, you have the wise woman, you know, broadcasting a message of wisdom. And down the dial, you've got the woman who we're meeting just now, the foolish woman. And she's broadcasting at the same time. It's prime time. You know, you could go to either channel. Likrolo ovre darech, hamiyashri marchosam. And they're recruiting similar people. Mifesi yasur hena, whoever is unlearned or unknowledgeable, come to me. V'chasar lev v'amralo. And if you don't feel like you have structure, you don't have a sense of morality in your life, come to me. You'll notice that this exact verse, Mipeti yasur hena v'chasar lev v'amralo, we had that in the fourth pasuk of the parak. Actually, word for word. Mifeti yasur hena v'chasar lev v'amralo. They're the same recruiting pitch. One is the woman of wisdom, one is the woman who is a fool. The woman of wisdom has constructive things to offer. The woman of, as we will see, foolishness has destructive things to offer. Mayim genuvim yimtako. She says, stolen waters, ain't those the sweetest thing? She says, if you really want to enjoy yourself, you gotta take what's not yours. V'lechem sisarim yinam. And the bread of conspiracy is oh so pleasant. They're both in the metaphor offering foods. Right? That's exactly what the wise woman said. Lechu lachmu v'lachmi. Partake of my bread. The woman, the surreptitious woman, the conniving, manipulative woman, also offers breads. But a very different kind of breads. In the Gemara in Sanhedrin is making a very interesting observation. The Gemara in Sanhedrin asks, why are people unfaithful? This is a question that's been in the news in the last 3 months. It's an article in the New York Times every day. Why is it that every single politician is involved in a scandal? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin has the same question. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin actually quotes from this pasuk, Mayim genuvim yimtako, because stolen waters are that much sweeter. In other words, people can't enjoy themselves when it's within their own marriage or their own stable relationships. There's something, in the thrill of going outside that appeals to people. Anyways, this is a very famous pasuk in the Talmud. Yeah, this Talmud uses this pasuk to explain this human phenomenon. Very interesting. But anyway, this is her message. Right? Get involved, basically, in the underworld. And you'll enjoy it. V'lo yada, and the person who's entrapped, lo yada ki rifa'im sham, he knows not that that's the path of death, b'imke sha'ol kiru'eha, that her calls lead him exactly the opposite direction that he wants to go in. So, I think it's, the reason we spent so much time reading the Tzukim today, I just want to show how these extended mishalim here, that are really very poetically constructed, and here you have the first six verses, are the wise woman calling out, and the last six verses of the parak are the woman, the corrupt woman calling out, and it's the same pitch but the opposite message, and it's all from a literary standpoint very elegant and very beautiful. But I want to take my question one step further. It's one thing to abandon those who need us the most, the people who are off on the wrong path to begin with, and the cynics and the scorners. We said, it's very difficult to justify that, but they're not going to like you, so they won't like you. It's a big problem today. You read about this, you talk to people about it, parents want to be their kids' friends. They want the kids to like them. So they don't tell them what to do, because what happens, you tell somebody what to do? So they resent it, doesn't matter who they are. Nobody wants to be told what to do. So if your goal is to be popular, so then the very smart thing to do is not to tell somebody what to do, including your children. But you want to help somebody, sometimes you have to give them a little instruction, a little constructive advice. So Mishle said, they're not going to like you if you criticize them. Big deal. Is that a particularly helpful piece of advice? I mean, no. So that was bad enough. But the last six verses, I think, take it to a whole new level. Why? Because if we don't reach out to them, what's Mishle saying? Somebody else will. If you're not willing to go there, I guess in Beth's analogy from a minute ago to the disco, then somebody else will. So it's a zero-sum game. If you check out and you say, I don't want to sell myself with this, I don't want to get involved in that okay, fine, but don't kid yourself, because there's somebody else who's selling their product, who's marketing the, you know, their wares. So that adds a whole other level of complication. It's given the fact that we know that you know, there are all kinds of people out there who are recruiting, so to speak, it's very difficult to understand why exactly we would put up any boundaries in terms of reaching out to those people who you know, we might not be able to, but we might be able to help. It's a very serious question. I don't want to answer it until next week. What I want to do is I want to really make the problem worse in the next half hour, if you don't mind. I think it's really important to think about, because I think it's one of those really complicated questions that people who are involved in studying Torah, people involved in Judaism, confront literally every single day in the society in which we live. And it's always the path of least resistance to say, I'm not getting involved. And if that's going to be the choice that we make, that's fine, but we should just at least understand it and understand and have thought critically about it. So I just want to continue to raise this issue. What do classical sources have to say about this? So the most important source is actually not in Mishlei. It's to come before that. The Mishlei source is a really important source. I'm going to show you next week that Shlomo's position on this matter was like incredibly influential when the Talmud wanted to develop a philosophy on this issue in terms of reaching out in constructive criticism and trying to rebuke people. Mishlei becomes a really important primary text that the Talmud is working with. So the most basic text, though, actually comes from the Torah. It says in Sefer Vayikra, beautiful pasuk, it says, Lo tisna et achicha bilvadecha. One is not allowed to hate one's brother in one's heart. The question is, well, what does that mean? If you really don't like somebody, what are you supposed to do about it? So I'll explain what exactly it means. So, Lo tisna es achicha bilvadecha. You're not allowed to hate your brother in your heart. I don't mean you're not allowed to be angry or frustrated with somebody. That's not what the pasuk is talking about. You're not allowed to basically revile them, hate them. But this is an issue. People hate each other.
Sometimes literally, okay?
Yeah, very. Sometimes even, there's no fight like a family fight. 100%. So, the pasuk says, Lo tisna es achicha bel vavecha. You're not allowed to. Hocheach tochiach es amisecha. You shall surely rebuke your nation. We'll explain what that means. Velo tisa alav chet, and do not bear sin because of him. So you have three clauses here. Number one, you're not permitted to hate your brother in your heart. Number two, you must assuredly, it's a double language, hocheach tochiach. We have double languages in Chumash. It's because we're trying to emphasize. You must assuredly rebuke your fellow. Velo tisa alav chet, and you shall not bear sin because of him. I want to explain all three verses. There are two primary interpretations. Both are true. They're not mutually exclusive. Just take a look at the Rashbam for the first one. The Rashbam, anybody know which line he comes from? The Rashbam is?
Rashi's grandson.
Excellent. He's Rashi's grandson. His mother is Rashi's daughter. And the Rashbam had a great role in actually transmitting Rashi's teachings. It just very briefly, just because it's worth a minute. Rashi lived 1040 to 1105. He had a particularly long life. The Rashbam was born in 1085. He was the oldest child in his family, and the Rashbam, when he was a young boy, and then when he was a teenager, studied with his grandfather every day. And he actually recorded many, many of his grandfather's teachings. And when his grandfather Rashi passed away, he finished Rashi's commentary on the Talmud for him. But that wasn't the only really important thing that he did. He did two other really important things. The first is that he taught a lot of what Rashi, his grandfather, taught him to his little brothers. And his little brothers were great scholars in their own right. Anybody here heard of Rabbeinu Tam? So Rabbeinu Tam was his little brother named Jacob. So Rabbeinu Tam was born 15 years after the Rashbam. He was much younger than him. So there's like almost a generation or a half generation gap between these two brothers. So the Rashbam taught Rabbeinu Tam a lot of what he had learned from the grandfather. Rabbeinu Tam didn't really know his grandfather, really. He was five when his grandfather passed away, roughly. So he wouldn't have had the opportunity to study with him, but the Rashbam actually taught his younger brother a lot. And then the third great contribution, the Rashbam wrote his own commentaries, both to Tanakh and to Talmud, which are of enormous value. So you have this like three-part role, finishing his grandfather's commentaries, transmitting his grandfather's teaching to the younger brothers, and thereby the successive generations, and then making his own contributions. And his hallmark is a very literal reading of the text. And he often talks about how he'll deviate from his grandfather's interpretations when he thinks that his grandfather was too allegorical. If Rashi is working based on what we call Medrashim or Agados, basically homiletic interpretation, sometimes the Rashbam gets a little frustrated. And he says, I know what my grandfather said. He knows better than any else what his grandfather said. But I want to explain this, what I think it's a simple meaning. So he has a beautiful interpretation here. He says, Lotisna sachi chabel babecha. Well, how can you legislate that? What are you supposed to do? If a person hates somebody, what do you do? So he says, in gemal chara, person who wrongs you, it happens all the time. So a person really does something inappropriate, unfair. And now his victim is obviously deeply resentful, bordering on hatred. So, lo tisra lefanav ke'ohev b'fiv, shalom esreyehu yidaber, v'kirbo yasim orvo, based on the pasuk in Mishlei. Basically, don't pretend, don't put on a facade, oh, everything's great. Because what's going to happen is you're going to hate the person in your heart. And this is just going to fester. So, lo tov hadavar asher ata osa, al tisanehu b'libecha, al tisnaehu b'libecha, rather, hash it out with them. Have an honest conversation. Be civil. And that way, do not hate your brother in your heart. Rather, point out, look, you cost me my job. You know, you cost me $100,000. Whatever the serious issues that people deal with. According to the Rashbam, and this scheme means, and thereby, you won't violate the sin of hating your brother in your heart. By having a mature adult conversation, that way you'll be able to avoid this problem. Now, that's a very important interpretation, and it provides one particular example of when it's appropriate to rebuke somebody, when the alternative is a kind of festering sense of dissonance and hatred, even, that could develop between the two parties. But it actually goes much further back.
It doesn't address the Mishpat.
Correct.
Because it's not talking about it's a personal...
100%. We're going to see in the Ramban what I'm looking for, meaning the more basic case. I just wanted to introduce that because I think it's important. I think it's important because I think it's practical. This happens all the time. Part of adult life is, you know, people have disagreements, and where there's no recourse to having a mature conversation. You know, religion doesn't mean, our religion doesn't say you have to turn the other cheek. It means you have to be an adult, and you have to have a civil conversation. But it's important if the alternative is a kind of festering hatred. Why is that any better? Think you're so righteous to walk around hating the person and scorning the person, be a lot better just to point out that you feel wrong and maybe you'll learn something. So I think that's a very important teaching. But as Beth points out, what we really need is the Ramban in Source 4. Because we're looking to establish generally that there's a mitzvah of hocheyach tochiyach. There's a general mitzvah that we have to be on the lookout for our fellow Jews. And that we don't hide behind their own piety. We don't say, well, I'm so religious, and, you know, I don't have to worry about you. So the Ramban says, Amar hocheach tochiach hasam isecha. Mitzvah acharis, this is an entirely new mitzvah. Lelamdo tochachas musar, to teach you the mitzvah. It is an obligation, not a choice. It's not a nice thing to do. This is a mitzvah. Like keeping kosher, keeping Shabbos, you have to do it. So you have to appropriately, properly rebuke your friends. V'lo tisar lav chet. What is it? The Ramban is now saying, what's the last clause? Do not carry a sin on his account. What does that mean? She'ia alecha asham. It will be your guilt and your sin. Kasher yechta. V'lo hochachta oso. A radical doctrine. If he sins and you had the opportunity to correct him, it's your sin. The pasuk says, "Hocheach tochiach asam yisecha." You shall assuredly rebuke your fellow, v'lo sisa alav chet, and that way you will not carry his sin. It means that if you don't do it, says the Ramban, it is your sin. So don't think, don't imagine to yourself that you can hide behind your tefillin and your tzitzis and your shiurim and your baruch hashems, and you're so you're holy and you're pious. Don't think you can hide behind those high walls, because it's your sin. You have a colleague who you couldn't be helping and concerned about, and you know, you assume that this guy doesn't know anything. You could help him, and you don't help him. You're responsible for his spiritual abandonment. So the stakes are high here. It's not as if we're saying, oh, it's a nice thing to do, and if you don't do it, chaval, you missed out on a nice thing, but if you don't do it, you're legally liable. It's on your account. So again, now that puts an enormous amount of pressure on where we started. You're going to tell me that the cynic and the scorner, Mishle, it's not worth it because he's not going to like you. What about Ochiach Tochiach Samisa? What about Losisa Lav Chait? What about you being liable for him, no matter what? Yeah,
Beth. But again, it comes back, in my mind, to whether the person who's doing it knows that what he's doing is wrong.
And even if they do?
If they do, so... Okay, you could say like the Nazhara, like an eight, like a few of an eight, so you like the Machal of Shabbos, the Mason, so you say to somebody, you know, you're giving them
right.
Nazhara.
Right.
But as far, okay, so I understand that, but there's a difference between informing somebody who would want to know about something they're
right.
doing or not doing, who doesn't know that what they should do or shouldn't do, or somebody who knows and is doing it anyway, or the third case, somebody who's a tinoch shenishba or something like that, where the person...
Fair enough, but let's take the most extreme case. Let's take somebody who knows it. You should give up on them. Abandon them, basically say they're too wicked. That wasn't Aaron's approach. We were talking about this before. I still have a problem with that. If it was your kid, think about it this way. It says in the Talmud, I'll tell you a story from the Talmud, and I think it's really important. There's a story where a bunch of women were taken captive. You know the story of Shmuel? This is the story of Shmuel. A bunch of women were taken captive, and they were... Okay, they were married to Kohanim. See, this is like, you know, it's like a broken record with this story. And I remember telling the story, because I like it so much. And a bunch of women, and the rule is that if a woman is raped, basically, it's a very tragic thing, married to a Kohen, there are problems with her getting back together with her husband. That's a very sad thing. But anyway, there was a question whether these women had been violated in captivity. And Shmuel, who was the major halachic decisor in Babel, he used to argue with a guy named Rav. Rav was like half a generation older than him. Rav passed away. Shmuel was basically the unquestioned halachic authority in Babel. And they came to Shmuel, they needed help. Because they weren't going to be able to get back together with their husband. So this was going to ruin their life, basically. And Shmuel was machmir. And Shmuel said he thinks it's a problem. He doesn't think they can get back together with their husbands because maybe they were violated in captivity. Well, he wasn't alive at the time. He'd already passed away. So Shmuel's father was sitting there in the room. Shmuel's father was an elderly man at that point. And he's listening to this, and he says to his son after the people leave, he said, if he's your daughter, would you have said the same thing? And that's always our standard. So, you know, that's my point. If it's one's own kid, does one give up because they know what they're doing is wrong? Four times, five times, six, there's just no limit. That's the commitment. So I find it surprising that there should be any limit. What's the risk? He's not going to like you, so he doesn't have to like you.
Well, I'm not so sure that parents who have a child who's doing that and they don't want to alienate that.
So that's something else. That goes back to... That goes back to, remember we said before, there are three reasons why you might not want to rebuke somebody. One of them is to say you're wasting your time. That I'm very unsympathetic to, because you may have to do it. The second approach, I think, is the best justification, so to speak, which is to say it'll be counterproductive. We keep on coming back to that. Yeah. But again, that's not what Shlomo said. Shlomo said it's just going to be an unpopular thing to do. Penis na'eka. He's going to hate you. So let him hate you. What's the problem with him disliking you? Why is your popularity more important than his welfare? Parents trying to be friends with a kid, it's not more important than the kid's welfare. So, again, in light of this Ramban, there's even greater pressure. Because what is the Ramban saying? The Ramban said, it's a sin. It's your sin now. You could have done something, and you didn't. Brian, go ahead.
If
it reaches that level. But when Shlomo said penis na'akam, I'm assuming that it's more like, he's annoyed with you. He basically finds you annoying, which is probably true. You probably are annoying. But sometimes you have to be annoying. Car alarms are also annoying. They have a function.
But they stop it eventually.
At some point. Some of them don't.
You know, there's something else. There's something else also.
Yeah.
How about all the people, amongst the sects, find any people or groups?
Right.
Like, we know about the Duke Kiru. You know.
Reach outreach. Is that fair translation? Outreach? Okay.
Yes.
Outreach.
Yes. Or in-gathering.
In-gathering.
Both. Outreach and in-gathering.
Fair enough.
But there are a lot of groups that don't. And the thing is, and I'm not criticizing them or myself or anybody else, I'm just throwing it out, that they don't do it because they say, we are not so strong that if we get involved with them, that it might not...
Right. So my question would be, how would the Ramban react to that? The Ramban says, if you could do it, and you don't do it, it's your sin. That's how you reach the pasuk.
What does it mean if you can do it?
Right. So a person has to be very honest. That's what I always say. It's always easier to say, what do I need from this? Why do I want the headache? I don't want to get involved. But we just have to remember that it's a mitzvah d'oraisa in the Torah, and then there's an associated iser with lo tisa l'abchit, which the Ramban said means that if you don't do it, it's on your account, man. So the counter pressure is enormous. I just wanted to share with you one Rambam. Again,
I was bringing that just to put pressure onto that statement.
Yeah. I think it increases, it ratchets up the pressure. Because if now it's your sin, you haven't saved anything. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're neutral and you say, well, either way, this doesn't come on my account, so I can hide behind my walls of piety, fine, but that's not the point of Rambam. That doesn't even happen. It's your sin. So I just wanted to, this is not the entire entry of the Rambam, and we're going to take a look at the rest of it. I just wanted to highlight a particular part, really the beginning. The Rambam codified what he considers to be the 613 mitzvot in the Torah. And this is not one of his more creative titles. He gathered them together and he called the book the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of the Mitzvot, whatever. His publisher thought it would still sell. Today they'd need colons and semicolons, the epic account of biblical mitzvot. But he just called it the Sefer Mitzvot. So this is an entry to the Sefer Mitzvot. And the Rambam is writing what he thinks, is a very important verse to know about this mitzvah. So the Rambam says as follows. This is the 205th mitzvah in the Torah. HaMitzvah HaReish Hei, the 205th mitzvah in the Torah. There are 248 positive commandments. 205 out of 248. Mitzvah 205. Shetivanu lehochia chachoti. So we have to rebuke the person who sins. Omi shiyur talachto. And even somebody who's not a sinner, but you see somebody who's heading down that path. So, person is basically, you find out, the guy is about to commit a tax fraud, right? He's just not going to report his earnings. You know this is going to happen. He's stealing. Omi shiyur talachto. Person is obligated, lohochiach, v'limnoa osomi menu, b'mamar b'tochach. You have to do what's in your power to stop the guy. You have to speak to him, you have to rebuke him. You have to. It's a mitzvah, it's a commandment. And now this isn't, the next line is my favorite line in the Rambam. And the Rambam knows what you're going to say. You're going to say, I don't want to get involved. And you're going to say, why do I need this headache? I got enough problems of my own. V'ein ro'i lanu sheyomar echad nimenu. And it's not fitting, it's not appropriate, it's just wrong for one of us to say, Ani lo echta, I'm a good person. I'm honest. I pay my taxes. V'im yechta zulasi, and if somebody else sins, mali, what do I care? Right? Live and let live. You want to say, mali, what do I care? It's amazing language in the Rambam. Why should I care? Dino im Eloha, that's between him and God. The Rambam says three words that are unforgettable. It says, Zeh hefech haTorah. This is the opposite of everything the Torah stands for. Because Torah rejects this idea of piety, and I'm so from, and I really don't have to care about anybody else. That's between them and God. I'm such a righteous person. That's abandonment of one's fellow. That is, the Rambam never ever uses this language in any other place. Zeh hefech haTorah. It is not just wrong, but it is against everything the Torah stands for. It is a corruption of all of Torah, because it reflects a kind of arrogance and isolationism and a sense of detachment from everybody else, a sense of being above it, that is completely unacceptable. And sometimes you have to get your hands a little dirty. Aval anachnu mitzuvim, the Rambam says very clearly, anachnu mitzuvim, we have been commanded twofold. Number one, shelo namre, that we should not rebel. We are responsible first and foremost for ourselves. However, on the second level, anachnu mitzuvim, number one, shelo namre, that we ourselves have to stay on the straight and narrow. V'lo nazov zulasenu miyumasenu sheyamre. We cannot abandon lo nazov. We cannot abandon zulasenu, someone else, from our umma, from our nation, to rebellion. We have been commanded twofold, for us and for everybody else. You're not an island. V'im yishtadel lahamros. And if the person is mishtadel, anybody know what that word means? The yishtadel is to... Yeah, the person is, you know, continuing to go down that path. He's resisting. Im hishtado lahamros, chayavim anu lehochicho lahashivo. You can't say, well, I tried. You tried once in 1983. In 1983, I invited him over for Shabbos. It's been 29 years, but, you know, I tried. No, that's not trying. You did not try. And even if you don't have concrete testimony, you're chayav. This is the mitzvah of the Torah. Okay, and then the Rambam goes on to explain, you'll recognize this from the Rashbam, he says a part of this whole commandment is, shenashim kitzasenu lekitzasenu kshech ta'ish mimenu le'ish, v'lo natar lo v'nachsho lo avon. This situation where one person, again, was wronged by his fellow, and now the two choices are, is he going to despise the guy, or going to hash it out? So the Rambam says in that situation you have to hash it out, because otherwise you're going to have the problem of hatred in the heart. Until you manage to, we can legislate you shouldn't hate somebody in your heart, because there are psychological ways of avoiding it. There's always the possibility of a conversation. To wrap up in just 3 minutes, I want to conclude with one thought. The Rambam, just as we spoke about the Rambam, the Sefer HaMitzvos, when the Rambam codifies in his magnum opus, the Mishneh Torah, which records all the Rambam's halachic thought, the Rambam records this mitzvah of responsibility to rebuke one's fellow. He sandwiches it in a very unlikely place. It comes directly after the mitzvah that we have to take care of gerim, people who convert to Judaism. So whenever you leave your native people, there's just always all kinds of psychological challenges, very understandable, and even pragmatic challenges. We don't even appreciate it, but because you're born in a certain community, you have all this kind of network. You have family, you have friends, you have people who you know, and it helps. We're not even conscious of how much it helps. But a person who comes from completely outside environment, there's all kinds of challenges. So we have a special mitzvah in the Torah that we have to do everything in our power to take care of them. Wonderful. That's the first part of the sandwich. The last part of the sandwich is that we have to take care of the almana and the yasam. That means the widow and the orphan. The widow and the orphan also have unique challenges, and we have to take care of them. It's special mitzvahs in the Torah that we're responsible for them. It's a very severe thing to neglect. No money also. Right in the middle, literally, right in the middle of those two halachos, the Rambam says, Hocheach Tochiach. What is it doing here? This is in the social welfare section of the Torah. But it's exactly the point. Because it's the same idea of not abandoning somebody when they need you the most. So there are different kinds of need. There's the need of a person who's not familiar, who's new. There's the need of a person who suffered tragic loss, the Alman the Yasa. There's also the need of a person who's not doing, you know, spiritually very well. They're vulnerable and they need you. So it's right after the ger, it's right before the Alman and the Yasam. And the point is, as the Rambam told us, it's about not abandoning your brother. Can't hide behind your high walls. So given that all these things are true, I find it, you know, quite shocking. Well, we're only going to begin to answer this next week. Hopefully people will think about it a little bit. Then Mishlei would say, Al tochach leitz pen yisna'eka. Don't bother rebuking the cynic, because he might not like you. Would any of us ever say, if our brother, our child, was self-destructing in any area of life, say, you know, you're not going to help him because he won't like you. The person has an addiction, God forbid. You're not going to try to get them the medical help they need because they'll be annoyed at you. Let them be annoyed. Let them hate you for 5 years. Let them hate you for 10 years. They'll, at some point, appreciate that you saved their lives. This happens all the time in so many different areas of life. Any snack, he's not going to like you. A very strange idea. So we're going to pick it up there next week.